This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In the past 25 years, I have done a lot of interviews on this program, but some really stick with you, and I'm going to play one for you now. Let me take you back to 1995 for a conversation with astronaut Jim Lovell, commander of the ill-fated Apollo 13 mission. The interview took place the week of the 25th anniversary of their historic nail-biting flight and the safe return to the Earth. There are certain dramatic events one remembers very vividly, you know, like remembering where you were when you heard the news about Kennedy or King. Well, for me, Apollo 13 falls into that category, too. I'll never forget that night. I was home in bed around 11 o'clock, 10, 11 o'clock at night, glued to the radio, listening, sleepless, to a heart-pumping drama that would play out all night, awaiting news about the lives of three people I had never even met before, who were cast adrift in a lifeboat with no hope for rescue from any other ship nearby, but with the slim possibility that if they were lucky and smart and sprung no leaks, their lifeboat would find its way home. But first it had to cross a huge ocean, perform in uncharted waters, and survive a fate that no other ship before it had ever faced. This, really, was the stuff of high drama and a throwback to the old days of radio, except that the story was pouring out of my tiny clock radio was real and live and more frightening than anything Hollywood science fiction writers could make up. And now as I sit and talk about it this afternoon, it's hard to believe that that terrifying night occurred 25 years ago. It seems just like yesterday. And the command pilot who had twice attempted to set foot on the moon and who was twice denied the opportunity, Jim Lovell, is my guest here today. He's author of the new book, Lost Moon, The Perilous Voyage of Apollo 13, published by Houghton Mifflin, and the head of Lovell Communications in Horseshoe Bay, Texas. He joins us by phone from his hotel in Costa Mesa, California. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Ira. How are you?
Fine.
What's it have to do now?
Well, wherever you are, you know what Einstein says. What are you up to these days?
Well, last night I attended the 25th anniversary of the Apollo 13 incident, and we celebrated it on the 13th, which was what we call Boom Day.
Is there a sort of a black humor about this now?
Well, you have to have a little humor, you know, in tight situations.
You weren't very humorous in those back 25 years ago on that night, were you?
No, I was a little apprehensive, a little frustrated, just about everything.
Did you really, in your heart of hearts, believe you were going to get out of that situation?
Well, when the explosion first occurred, we didn't know the severity of it because we were losing fuel cells, but one fuel cell would have been sufficient for us to get home. And then we saw the oxygen going out, then we knew that the third fuel cell would die, and then pretty soon the whole command module would collapse on us. And that's when we got to be starting to worry about whether we would ever get home again.
You've said that if the explosion had happened earlier or later, you and the crew would not have survived. Why is that?
That's true. If the explosion occurred just after we committed ourselves to leave the Earth and go to the moon, we would not have had enough battery power in the lunar module to make that transit all the way around the moon, and we could not turn back because we had no ability to fire our command module's engines because we lost all the electrical power. Had this explosion occurred after we were orbiting the moon and we had detached to go down to the lunar surface, we would not have had enough fuel in the lunar module once we got back up to get out of lunar orbit and propel ourselves back to the Earth.
So that was really the only lucky part of the mission.
Yes, it was very, very fortunate that if we were going to have an explosion, to have it at that time.
Three big men were able to squeeze into a little lunar module equipped for two people that was only designed for two people for 2 days. The story of how you got enough air to breathe and water to and food to live on is fascinating. What did you have to do to turn that into a lifeboat?
Well, we had to do several things. First of all, we had to use its propulsion system to reestablish the proper course on the way home. Then we had to use the same propulsion system to speed up our return home because, as you mentioned, that vehicle was designed only for 45 hours and two people. And as I looked around, I counted three, and I didn't want to be left behind, so I thought we better stretch it out. And also, we had to use his guidance system for a while, so we had to transfer all that guidance information from the dying command module into the lunar module. And since the temperature was dropping anyway, it was kind of crowded, but our body warmth kept us comfortable just a little bit.
You know, the space program of the last 40 years is always filled with defining moments when something happens and a technician or an engineer or somebody makes that incredible decision about to go or not to go or to do something. What was that moment on your flight?
Well, there were several moments because we had crises to overcome all the way home. I think the first critical decision was the crew's decision to get into the lunar module, which came quite a bit earlier than when the ground finally realized that we did have all these things going wrong with us. And we got in there and turned on those systems with just enough time to transfer the guidance information. That was the first critical. The second one was a ground decision that says, let's get them back on that free return course again. And they did that. The third one was a decision that was not a hard one to decide, but Hayes came up and said, we don't have enough battery power in the lunar module to get home. And the ground agreed at the same time. And then they said they think we have a solution, and that was their decision to burn the engine for a second time for a long period of time after we passed the back of the moon. And, of course, the final decision was to, again, readjust our course, which was necessary, but we had to do that by the seat of the pants because we had turned off all those exotic electronic devices to help us navigate. See, we had our navigational equipment in the command module. We had very similar equipment in the lunar module. And we held those two, made it together all the way home. But after we lit our engine for the second time and had it on for about 4.5 minutes, then we shut everything down to save electrical power so that we'd have enough power to keep control of the vehicle all the way home. And when we did that, we had to turn off all the exotic electronic navigational equipment, so we lost in the memory of the computer the position of the navigable stars, and we turned off the guidance system so the platform went down. The autopilot wouldn't work anymore, and we thought that we could just coast back on what we call the free return course until we found out that we had to make another adjustment. So we did lose those equipments as far as being able to use them, but they were still in the lunar module.
There were a couple of times in the mission where your microphones were on and you didn't know it, and you said some things that you may have later regretted, but probably not anymore. But there was one interesting comment that you'd said to Fred Hayes. He said, I'm afraid this is going to be the last moon mission for a long time. That didn't pan out that way, did it?
Oh, no. I said that. Well, first of all, I thought I was on what we called Vox, voice activated, or push to talk.
Right.
In other words, I thought I'd have to push the button before anything would go outside of the spacecraft. And so I was just talking to Fred. We were looking at the moon just as we got in there and said that this is good. I said, take a good look at the moon, Fred. It's going to be a long time before anybody gets back here.
Why did you say that?
Because that's exactly what I thought at the time.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's true.
We had no propulsion. We had no electricity. We had no, nothing. And I knew that NASA was going to have to do some real great research. And, of course, there was still a great chance that we'd never get back alive.
And you were able to, at one point, to turn around and actually see the exploded oxygen tank on the side of the service module. And your reaction must have been incredible about the amount of damage you could see.
Well, just before we hit the Earth's atmosphere on the way home, we jettisoned the service module. We maneuvered slightly so that as it tumbled by, hopefully we could take some pictures, which that occurred. We took some pictures and saw the whole side of the spacecraft blown off.
And how long did it take for them to find out what really went wrong?
It took about 3 months of intensive investigation after the splashdown. We looked at the history of the spacecraft's building. We went back and looked at the telemetry. We reproduced in laboratories what we thought went wrong. We had a pretty good idea, fairly shortly, but we had to reproduce the situation by testing, and then we finally got the answer. Most accidents in aircraft are caused by a series of incidents that either overcome the pilot and or the airplane. This was a classic example of that situation. The accident was set up 5 years before we took off. When NASA at that time informed all the contractors to make the electrical equipment in the spacecraft compatible with the high voltage, which I think was about 65-volt DC voltage at Cape Kennedy, even though the spacecraft flew with only 28-volt DC power. And the main reason was they could do some testing a lot quicker at the Cape with the higher voltage. Everybody did, except the fellow who built the heater system in the oxygen tank. The heater system had a little thermostat to prevent it from getting too hot, but it was compatible with only the 28-volt power and not the higher voltage that was available at the Cape.
You made mention of later on that when they discovered what a good lifeboat that the LAM could be, that it was changed to be able to be a lifeboat. In what ways was the LEM changed to be more hospitable? Or did you know that it was changed?
Well, I don't think it was changed physically as much as the procedures were incorporated to in case that this thing happened again.
I see.
That the lunar module could be used as an auxiliary propulsion system or a living space while there was something wrong with the command module.
We're talking this hour about the dangerous mission of Apollo 13. Jim Lovell, the commander of Apollo 13 and an astronaut for many years and author of the book Lost Moon, The Perilous Voyage of Apollo 13, published by Houghton Mifflin, which has been made into a film starring Tom Hanks. And we'll find out, does Tom Hanks do a good Jim Lovell, Jim?
Oh, yeah, he's an excellent actor.
I didn't ask that question. I said, does he do a good Jim Lovell?
he spent 4 days down with me, and he got the character down pretty pat. And, he was a closet astronaut. He always wanted to play the part of an astronaut when he got in the acting business, and he finally found the product that he wanted to do.
We'll be back with more of my 1995 conversation with Apollo 13 astronaut James Lovell. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
Yeah, that's just what I'm saying. The time to do it is now. Guidance.
Fly again.
Go, guidance.
As long as
you're listening to the audio from Apollo 13 Mission Control in Houston. It was a little after 10 p.m. on the night of April 13, 1970. Over the hours that followed, the ground controllers and the astronauts on board Apollo 13 would have to come up with a way to deal with the damage from an onboard explosion and invent a way to get the crippled spacecraft and its crew back home safely.
All right.
Both have mattered, as well as why don't you tell them what page you want in the checklist.
Okay. Flight Tommy.
Okay,
we
got a problem here.
What's the matter with the data you got?
The heater current looks normal.
Okay. We got more than a problem.
Okay, listen, you guys. We've lost fuel cell 1 and 2 pressure.
We lost O2 tank 2 pressure.
You can see, you want to look at it?
And temperature.
We've had a problem.
Okay.
Stand by, they got a problem.
See a hardware.
Roger, main B undervolt.
Negative flight.
O2 tank 2 pressure?
I believe the crew reported.
We got a main B undervolt.
Okay, Flight, we've got some instrumentation fines. Let me add them up.
Roger.
Okay, stand by, 13. We're looking at it.
We may have had an instrumentation problem, Flight.
Roger.
Okay, let's get our instrumentation lined up here, you guys. ECS, what do you got? Brown, are you copying us? Air to ground.
Yeah, voltage is...
O2 tank 2...
Looking good, yeah.
Pressure, O2 tank 1 fluctuating...
coming down on O2
tank. And we had a pretty large bang associated with the caution and warning there. And as I recall, Main B was the one that had a amp spike on it once before.
We're playing excerpts from a 1995 interview with Apollo 13 Commander Jim Lovell. It was the week of the 25th anniversary of the flight, and sure enough, the movie starring Tom Hanks would come out but a few months later.
Is that reflected anywhere?
Negative. No, it's
negative.
Not a signal gate.
Say again, Larry.
No signal gate. No common signal gate.
You and your co-author Jeffrey Kluger have captured some of the real drama that was going on. I mean, the real drama of that first night and subsequent nights that we sat through and listened to. And in particular, when it came time where you and your fellow astronauts had to push a button, and it had to be the exact right button. And if you didn't push that button at that moment, it was curtains. Well, the lights were out forever.
Fred and I were in the lunar module, and it would have ruined our whole day if he jettisoned us by mistake.
And there was one point where one of the astronauts, the command module astronaut, had to transfer the data from the command module into the lunar module, and he had to do it by voice. And first he had to mentally make calculations, do a little bit of arithmetic, and he so distrusted himself in that time of stress that he wasn't sure what 5 times 3 was. But that there must have been, you have to control your fear in that case so much just to understand what 5 times 3 is, that the pressure must have been enormous.
It was pretty high, yes.
Is there anything in your training that makes you prepared for that moment?
Well, I think the background of all three of us was a big help to this situation, because all three of us were test pilots. All three of us had been in a stressful situation before in airplanes that weren't behaving the way they should. And so that familiarity with the stressful environment, I think, really helped us.
All right, we have a lot of people who'd like to ask some questions, so let me go to the phones. 1-800-989-8255. Mike in Coralville, Iowa. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mr. Lovell. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I'm a very big admirer of yours. My question for you was there any one time that you were completely despaired that you would not get back? And consequently, was there a time when you just came to a realization that you were going to get back?
To answer your first question, there was never a time when we were completely despaired. There was a time of greatest apprehension was when we, shortly after the explosion occurred, and we saw the oxygen escaping from the spacecraft, and we realized that very shortly the command module would die, and we didn't have solutions at that time of how we're going to survive the entire trip back home. The command module was the only thing that had a heat shield.
Oh, yeah.
Let's go now to Barry in Philadelphia. Hi, Barry.
Hi. Thank you very much. I'd like to know what kind of extraterrestrial experiences you gentlemen experienced during this mishap that you had there.
And you mean anything that's strange that we saw that we didn't understand?
Yes.
Well, in the vicinity of the moon, we saw a couple dark shadows or shafts out in the void someplace, which we couldn't quite identify at the time, but we think that they were pieces of debris that had followed us to the moon after the explosion and were blotting out some of the stars. But quite frankly, none of us, of the astronauts that I know of, believe in what we call so-called UFOs. We all believe that there's life in the universe, intelligent life as we know it, but no foreign visitors around the Earth that come from some other galaxy or some other star system.
Why is it that that NASA could command such great attention from the public and have thousands of reporters in the 60s and the 70s, and now when the shuttle is up and there are astronauts up, you hardly see a mention of it anywhere? Have we really lost the desire for space? Are we jaded? Jim Lovell, what do you think it is?
Well, I think it's a natural tendency. I remember before the explosion occurred on Apollo 13, and that was 25 years ago, none of the networks carried it. The flight, it was on page 78 of the New York Times about 2 days before the flight. That was the only mention of the flight. We become complacent with space flight, and it wasn't until the accident occurred that there was this great interest. It's like, I guess it's like going to an automobile race. Everybody's waiting for the crash on the first curve. And we've had over 60-some shuttle flights now, and they've become very routine. And I look at the shuttle as a proven vehicle, much like an airplane, and the action occurs inside the payload bay, whether we're putting up a new satellite or doing some new experiments in space.
Let's go to the phones to Dan in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Mr. Lovell, this is an honor. I'd like to know if you could take the opportunity to tell us about your crewmates, Fred Hayes and the late Jack Swigert.
Yes, I couldn't have picked two better crewmates to weather the accident with me than Jack Swigert and Fred Hayes. Of course, as you know, Jack was not the original command module pilot on this flight. Ken Mattingly was. And we were exposed to the measles 4 days before we were to take off, and Mattingly, being a bachelor, everybody was sure he was going to come down with him. And so they replaced him with Swikert because Swikert had the measles. And he died, unfortunately, in early 1983. Fred Hayes is still actively employed with the Grumman Northrop or Marriott. Well, I forget exactly who they went with, but that that organization. All three are very competent, and, of course, all three are in the book.
All right. Thanks for calling, Dan.
Thank you.
Are you the only person who has ever gone to the moon twice and not set foot on it? And is this a great disappointment now as you look back?
Yes, because the Apollo 13 was going to be the peak of my career. I was going to land on the moon. I told everybody, including the press, that this was my last flight. I would go into NASA management or something like that. And I thought I couldn't think of a better way of capping a career. And then, of course, we didn't land. And there was, when the explosion first occurred, of course, there was a lot of frustration because we lost a fuel cell. The mission rules said that we couldn't land without all three fuel cells operating.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it was one of survival. We forgot about the frustration. Now I look at it sort of wistfully that it was really a sense of a great triumph to take an almost certain catastrophe and then, you know, bring this thing home safely with the help of the ground. And it gives me a little bit of sense of satisfaction to be on a flight that had such an interesting beginning, middle, and ending.
John in Encinitas, California. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. And I'd like to say hi to Jim. It's really incredible to be able to talk to you on the phone. I've been listening to you for about half an hour, and I've got to say you guys were incredibly cool under unbelievable pressure. That's the one thing I'd like to say. But then I have a technical question on top of that.
Go ahead.
You said that the oxygen thermostat, the heater for the oxygen tank, had a 28 volt, I think it was, thermostat on it, or it should have been 65 volts. So I assume that burnt out at some point. But then what happened? I mean, what was the sequence beyond?
Okay, yes, I didn't finish my story there.
Right.
A second incident occurred. The tank was dropped slightly at the factory years before it was to be put into the service module. Mm. They retested it. And then about 6 weeks before takeoff, we had a countdown demonstration test of where we completely filled the tank full of oxygen, and the tank worked perfectly for everything that it would have to do in flight. After the test, the ground crew went in to remove the oxygen, and when they tried to force it out with the gas, which was the normal procedure, the gas was going out instead of the liquid, so they looked at the schematics of it, and they found out that there was a loose tube, and that might have occurred when they dropped the tank, and so they decided to use the heater system to boil it out. First time they ever used it for 8 hours of any spacecraft. They turned it on. The heater system worked. The oxygen started to boil out. The temperature started to rise. As it got to about 80 degrees, the little thermostat started to open up to keep the temperature down. The high voltage welded the contact shut. No safety at all. The temperature kept rising, but no one ever caught the fact that the heater did not turn off at the proper time. It got up to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit in that tank, damaged all the wiring, and damaged the Teflon covering, but no one ever caught it.
You know, this may be a different day and age, but if this news had come out now about something that happened on the shuttle, there would be tremendous congressional hearings and things like this that would be going on. Now, in those days, I guess they would just said, well, there was a chain of mistakes, and life goes on.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was a very fortunate ending to this thing, so therefore it's a lot easier to, to make corrections and go ahead. If we had died on the way home, well, you might never have known what happened. That the thermostat was in all the flights from 8 all the way through 13.
That's very interesting. For me, if the tank rattles, I throw it out. I get a new tank.
We debated about changing tanks, but it would just delay the flight another month. And since the tank worked perfectly for everything that we had to do in flight, and we'd never detank it on the way out to the moon, we saw no problem with it.
But that delay and that month was critical in the period of the space race we were talking about. I mean, there is a tight schedule. And was there sort of the politics of the time that even a month would be too much to delay?
Well, there wasn't much of a race anymore. As you recall, we landed on the moon, and Apollo 8 went around it for the very first time. There was a schedule to keep it. But safety was still very, very important, and they looked at everything positively and said the tank was working fine. And they looked at the schematics before we made a decision to go and said, if that little tube is loose, there's no problem. We don't need that little tube on the flight. We'll just turn the heater on and boil the oxygen out, and then we'll keep going. But no one ever thought that it went up to 1,000 degrees. We only had a temperature gauge outside the test stand that went to 80, which was a big mistake.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI.
All right, let's go to Stevie in Wayland, Mass. Hi, Stevie.
Hi. I was wondering if I could ask Mr. Lovell, what do you think the future holds for the space program?
Well, that is a big question. I think the future holds a space station, probably basically, this is for manned flight, a consortium between Russia, the European Space Agency, Japan, Canada, and the U.S. I think we're finally going to get our act together. It's too bad that we wasted billions on studies that never came to anything. Nations go. I think that we're going to start doing some robotic research on the planets of Mars again and perhaps make another landing on Venus, with the eventual idea of perhaps a manned Mars flight sometime in the next century.
Martin in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Martin.
Hello. It's an honor to speak to you, Mr. Lovell. One question. I realize that your craft was the best that we could build at the time, but how would it compare by today's standards? Just how primitive was it by today's standards?
Well, it is pretty primitive. We had just one type of computer. It was a hardwired computer. We didn't have such things as floppy disks or all the modern stuff that computers have. I think the shuttle takes off with five of them. They're not all talking to each other. We don't go. The instrumentation was rather crude compared to what we have today. The technology today would probably be able to reduce the weight considerably. But as far as the technology was with other stuff in those days, it was highly advanced.
Mm.
That computer was actually, we call it the fourth astronaut.
All right, Martin.
Okay,
thanks for calling.
Much.
There are still three. There were supposed to be 20 Saturn missions, Saturn V missions, Apollo missions, and they cut them back to 17, and there are three Saturn rockets lying around various places around the country. One's at the Cape, one is, Huntsville?
Yes.
And where's the third one? I'm trying to remember.
Johnson Space Center.
Johnson Space. When you drive by that and you look at that, do you get pangs when you see that there? It gives me pangs saying, I wish this was standing straight and going someplace,
Well, I think one of the tragedies of our decisions in NASA was not to keep the line of the Saturn V running a little bit longer. And I tell you why. We spent all that money for research and development. It's a beautiful rocket. It puts more into low Earth orbit than the shuttle does. And when the Challenger accident occurred, we had no backup.
Yeah.
And we could have had a fairly inexpensive backup if we kept those Saturn V's on the line.
Jim, is there one memory you take away from this more than any other part of the flight? That one thing that stays in your mind?
Well, I'll never forget the sight of the moon as we whipped around it for the very last time. My second flight up there, knowing that I'd never get a third flight. And finally seeing that little triangular mountain that I had named on Apollo 8, Mount Maryland, and it started to disappear in the background. And it was sort of a nostalgic, wistful feeling. At that time, I think we had a fairly decent idea that we might be able to make through this thing okay.
And how many do the astronauts these days, do they stay in contact with each other from those early years?
Oh, yes. We see each other a lot. NASA very nicely invites us down to Houston once a year to brief us on what the latest things that are going on. And then we have things like the, anniversaries. I saw Buzz Aldrin and Jack Schmidt last night. And we get other astronauts together.
All right, Jim Lovell, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very, very much for joining us this hour.
Thanks, Ira.
That interview was recorded in April of 1995. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As we mark our 25th year, it's interesting to look back and discover just how many discoveries were announced on this program. And we're revisiting some of them today, like this one nearly 20 years ago, with astrophysicists Neda Bacall and Wendy Friedman. Teams led by Saul Perlmutter, Adam Riess, and Brian Schmidt had just announced the discovery that the expansion of the universe was not slowing down, but accelerating. And that discovery, as you know, came to be known as dark energy. It was also a time when we believed the universe was much younger than recent calculations have suggested.
Welcome back to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're going to take you to the outer reaches of the universe now, and you won't need to stand in line or get popcorn all over the floor either, so don't worry about that. Long ago, say about 1929, Edwin Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding. And ever since then, astronomers and astrophysicists have tried to pin down exactly how fast that expansion is taking place. Because the answer to that has a lot to do with big questions like how old the universe is and what's going to happen to it in the distant future. And I mean distant, we're talking billions of years from now. Well, this week, a team of astronomers working on a project on the Hubble Space Telescope, the key project of the Hubble, in fact, announced that after 8 years, they have the best estimate for that number to date. And that number we're talking about is called the Hubble constant. And it will help clear up a lot of mysteries about the universe. And for the rest of this hour, we're going to be talking about research into astrophysics and the Hubble constant, the Hubble Space Telescope. Same name, different kind of thing. And joining me now are Dr. Netta Bacall, a professor of astronomy at Princeton University Observatory in Princeton, New Jersey. She's also one of the authors of a paper in Science magazine this week reviewing some of the most recent cosmological research. And she joins us from the Princeton campus. Welcome to the program.
Well, nice to be here, Ira.
Nice to have you. Dr. Wendy Friedman, an astronomer at Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, California, and team leader of the Hubble Key Project. She joins us from Batavia, Illinois. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Friedman.
Very nice to be here.
The project you've been working on, the key project of the Hubble, the main thing it was designed to do, right?
That's right. When the Hubble Space Telescope was first being planned, in fact, this was the project that the Hubble was designed to do in terms of priority. It was a number one ranked project.
To find out what the Hubble constant is, to pin it down.
To pin it down to an accuracy of 10%. It's something that astronomers and astrophysicists have been arguing about at a level of a factor of 2.
And what is the argument? Basically, give us the argument and why that's so important.
The unknown, what we're trying to measure is how fast the universe is expanding. The Hubble constant measures that rate at the current time. And if we can measure how fast the universe is expanding now, that gives us some information. In a sense, it's like playing a movie in reverse. If we know how fast it's expanding, then we can tell how long it's been expanding. And it gives us information about the age of the universe, if we also know what the density of the universe, of matter in the universe is. And it turned out to be much more difficult to measure than originally anticipated by Edwin Hubble when he discovered the expansion. And the real difficulty comes in measuring how far away galaxies are from us. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Hubble Space Telescope allows us to do much more accurately than it was done in the past.
So you pointed the telescope at some key stars to look for that constant?
The way we measure distances, one of the most accurate means that astronomers have to measure distances to galaxies, depends on a certain type of star. It's known as a Cepheid. And it has a unique property that it changes in its brightness. And that's not true for most stars. If we look at the sky, and if we just look up at the stars at night, they don't change, at least on timescales of an ordinary human lifetime. But these Cepheids change on timescales of maybe 2 or up to a few months, 2 days or to a few months. And how fast they change is directly related to how bright they are. And that gives us a unique predictor of the distance. And it turned out that from the ground, it was very difficult to find these stars in very many galaxies. But by getting above the Earth's atmosphere, which the Hubble does, we don't have the blurring that takes place because the atmosphere is in motion. And so suddenly we could survey a volume that was 1,000 times as great, or a distance 10 times as great as we could do from the ground. And that was the real breakthrough that Hubble allowed.
And what number did you come up with for the Hubble constant?
The number we came up with for the Hubble constant is 70. That's in funny units that astronomers use of kilometers per second per megaparsec. And what that means in units that are more familiar is that a galaxy that it's at a distance of about 3 million light years from us would be moving at a speed of 160,000 miles per hour. And what the Hubble expansion or the Hubble law tells us is that the further a galaxy is away from us, the faster it's moving. So an object 10 times further away is moving 10 times faster than that.
So now that we know how fast the universe is expanding, does that narrow down the age of the universe?
It does narrow down the age, but I want to emphasize also that it's not the only quantity that we need to know to determine the age. We need to know, one, how fast is the universe is it expanding, and two, how much matter is there in the universe? And the reason you need to know how much matter there is that gravity will tend to slow the expansion down.
Right.
And we call this quantity the Hubble constant, which only refers to it being constant at the time we're measuring it now. That actually changes over time because of the presence of gravity, and then possibly other forces which might be accelerating the universe. Mm-hmm. And so we need to know all those quantities to accurately determine the age. But if we use the best estimates for what the matter density is, and that's something that Dr. Bacall is an expert in, then we come out with an age for the universe of about 12 billion years, given this Hubble constant that we've measured with the Space Telescope. And if there is an accelerating universe, that means that the universe is speeding up. So in the past, the Hubble constant would have been smaller. And that leads to an older age for the universe. So it could be as high as 13 or perhaps even 15 billion years old in that case.
Dr. Bacall, how confident are you in this new estimate of the age of the universe?
Well, it seems to be a quite robust estimate within the range that we just heard that Wendy was talking about. There are many different measurements now regarding the mass density of the universe and some suggestions about whether the universe may be accelerating or not. Combining it with the measure of the Hubble constant that we just heard from Wendy, really gives quite a robust estimate for what the age of the universe is based on the model, which is ranging from about 12 billion years to about 14 or 15 billion years if there is this extra energy, that sort of anti-gravity force in the universe that pushes the expansion and accelerates it. And that age seems to be very consistent with the direct observations of the age of the oldest stars in the universe.
You haven't been able to answer what that strange expansion force is.
Well, the interesting thing is when you put together all these recent observations, the data does suggest, and not only from one source, but from different types of observations, that such energy, dark energy, we call it, something that opposes gravity and anti-gravity types of energy, pushes back and accelerates the expansion rate of the universe, which is really quite puzzling. As Wendy just mentioned, if we had, as we have been thinking all the way since the days of Hubble, if there was only matter in the universe, and that was the expectation, the only thing that matter can do by its gravitational attraction is slow down the expansion of the universe.
Right, because it's got
down
the gravity would pull itself back.
Itself back together. Right. And what the observations suggest is that instead of slowing down the expansion rate of the universe, the expansion rate may actually be speeding up. And that is very strange because gravity can just not do it. It's like when you throw a ball in the air, you expect it that at some point, depending on how fast you throw it, at some point gravity of the earth will pull it back down. And you will be terribly surprised if you throw the ball in the air and it will keep just receding from you faster and faster and faster. Then you'll ask, well, what's doing it?
I hate it when that happens. What is the universe expanding into?
Yes, I think that's a fascinating question. And one way of explaining it in the sort of expansion of the universe or the history of the universe, it's not a question of where is it going to, there is some other space outside there and we are moving into, but that the universe itself, the space-time itself generated by the matter and the energy in the universe is the one that is stretching the universe and creating the space and time.
It's hard to imagine. Our analogies just break down at some point, don't they?
I think that's exactly right, Ira. The analogy of what we are used to from our life here on Earth, or even getting a little bit outside of our Earth to the solar system and nearby stars, starts breaking down intuitively when we think about sort of the edges of the universe or how the universe started and where is it going and so on.
Falling Waters, West Virginia. Go ahead.
If particles are traveling out into space, eventually I figure they would, by theory, lose gravity of each other. And if there was any kind of a minor curve in the universe, it seems to me without gravity they would loop around and come back to their close to the original spot. I wanted to ask your guests, have they measured any curve in the universe at all through their measurements?
That's a very interesting question. This is one of the things that we address in our review article in today's science issue, where we combine the different observational results of the last couple of years or so, few years, and the combinations of the different observations suggest that the universe is flat, that we do not see any curvature in the universe, that there is some acceleration, as we talked about, and that the mass of the universe is much too small to stop the expansion.
So it is flat, you're saying?
Yes, the suggestion of the putting together all these current observations.
So what happened to the whole idea of curved space and things like that? That's done.
Yes, well, the space is curved depending on how much matter and how much energy exist in it, as predicted by Einstein, of course, earlier in the century from general relativity. And these recent measurements combined together, both from supernova observations and from this old remnant from the Big Bang, the microwave background radiation, combining this together with the mass density that we observe, suggests that the total mass plus energy in the universe is exactly balanced to give it a flat space. In other words, no significant curvature.
I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI. You're listening to an interview with astrophysicists Netta Bhakal and Wendy Friedman from 1999. About the accelerating expansion of the universe. Dr. Friedman?
Yeah, another way of expressing that is that astronomers or cosmologists talk about something called a critical density, which corresponds to this flat case that Netta is referring to. And so if there is more matter in the universe than this critical density, then the expansion of the universe would be halted eventually, and the universe would collapse back on itself. If there's less matter than this critical density, then the universe could keep expanding forever.
So this
critical boundary, the so-called critical density, is where it's right at that value equal to the critical density.
So, you know, Fred was asking, you know, so what would happen then if I send a light beam out into space, theoretically? It could go on forever and never come back?
Yes.
Something different than we've been thinking about all these years.
Well, that depends exactly on what the curvature is, as we discussed, what the curvature of the universe is.
So, right.
It's a way of expressing the geometry, and if we live in a flat universe, and that's what the best current theories suggest, is that somehow very early in the universe there was a very rapid, exponential, in fact, exponentially fast period of expansion that essentially flattened out the geometry.
Fred, blow your mind like Kramer would say. It's blown my mind.
Stranger and stranger. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. I have to go back to this flat space idea because it's just something I think it's shocking.
That's the most mind-boggling thing, isn't it?
Well, does that mean all these, you know, these Star Trek ideas where you have wormholes and things because space is curved and you can go through these time is now gone because we don't have curved space anymore?
Another thing we didn't allude to is that, you know, the basis of all this Big Bang theory of the universe is general relativity, which essentially tells you that matter curves space, and there are regions of very high density black holes and other exotic, interesting objects where there can be such effects that people are investigating that touch on science fiction, wormholes.
So that'll happen at those local areas, then, where you have black holes and things like that.
Well, there are certainly curvatures every place. Matter, as Einstein general relativity theory says, there is curvature anytime you have matter. But when we look, the question was about the global curvature of the universe.
Right.
Not there.
There, the suggestion is that there is probably no curvature, that it's probably flat, possibly due to this very rapid inflationary state right after the Big Bang. Mm.
I have about a minute for one last question. What do you do now, Dr. Friedman? You've answered the key question, right? You've got the Hubble. Do you just close up the lid on the Hubble and say goodbye now? Is that it?
Well, I guess I would say we've answered one of the key questions. But I also like to mention that there are other telescopes that are currently on the drawing board that are going to come online in the next decade that are also very exciting. And Hubble still is continuing to do lots of interesting things, many of which were not anticipated when the telescope was built.
And another key question the Hubble needs to answer quickly? I mean, is there something else that...
Now, many exciting things that Hubble Space Telescope, of course, is doing. The Hubble Constant is clearly one of the key projects from the beginning, but there are many exciting discoveries that are coming almost weekly or monthly from the Hubble Space Telescope, and we certainly expect it to keep doing that.
And we'll keep coming back and talking about it as these results come in, because it is truly exciting. And I'd like to thank both of you for joining me, Dr. Netta Bacall, Professor of Astronomy at Princeton's Observatory in Princeton, New Jersey, Dr. Wendy Friedman, Astronomer at Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena, and Team Leader of the Hubble Key Project. Thank you both for joining me today.
Well, thank
you. Nice to talk to you.
You're welcome.
B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, Room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can also email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter all week long. Have a great holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.